This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So what did the British do? Very clever move. They abolished the Persian language as the language of administration. They replaced it with Urdu and Hindi. And they did this as a deliberate move to take away 600 years, if not 800 years of hard work of the Muslims. They took it in one stroke. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. So I was talking about the mutiny. It is called the Indian Mutiny or the Great Rebellion or the War of Independence, depending on the perspective. It happened in 1857. I was explaining earlier. It was caused by a number of factors. And if I was to simplify it and put it in short terms, it was caused by a feeling of lack of satisfaction on the part of these soldiers who rebelled against the officers. Their pays were bad, they weren't paid good, they were being discriminated against, there was racism among British officers, and most importantly, their religion was being insulted. The Hindus as well as the Muslims, as I explained earlier, they used cartilages that contained pig and cow fat. And this is what really triggered the rebellion. Feelings were already high. Muslims and Hindus were already not happy with the way the British were ruling. From the year 1803, you can see what the pattern was of the East India Company, taking more and more territory, causing more and more intrigues, taking on more and more local principalities. If you did not toe their line, they would remove you. They would cause conspiracies against you, or they will conspire with other powers against you and they will remove you in power. So if you toe the line, if you listen to the East India Company and follow their foreign policy, so what did they say to these local principalities? That you can rule yourselves, you can raise taxes, you can remain kings and princes and queens, but the foreign policy will be defined by us. We will dictate the foreign policy. Your foreign negotiations, you cannot negotiate with us, and you will have to have one of our political agents in your court present at all time. And he has to be aware of all the business you're doing. So basically, they would plant one of the agents at every single Indian court for this agent to watch all the political maneuvering within the court so that he can report back to the Governor General in Calcutta, and then they would take appropriate action where necessary. This is why Tipu Sultan was attacked. This is why the Marathas were later on attacked. This is why the Nizam in Hyderabad continued in his position as, or his descendants continued as the Nawabs or as the Nizams. Nizam was the ruling title, okay? They continued as Nizams because they towed the line. They never challenged the British on anything. They said, okay, let us rule, let us govern. And, you know, so that's why those principalities that remained in power up to the year 1947, when the British left India, those powers remained in power because they towed the line. So those who did not tow the line, like the Sikhs, for example, were also removed. As I mentioned earlier, the Sikhs had taken a lot of territory in the Punjab. And in 1799, a young adventurer called Maharaja Ranjit Singh came to power in the Punjab and eventually took territory from Multan to Peshawar. You may be shocked now to hear this, but let me tell you that for 40 years, this man called Maharaja Ranjit Singh ruled territory in current day Pakistan, okay, and within India as well, in eastern Punjab. He ruled territory stretching from Himalayas in the north, from Peshawar, let's say, to Multan, all basically the best part of the Punjab. It was an empire. It was a Sikh empire. And the British, after taking Delhi in 1803, had their eyes on the Sikh empire too. They want one after another. They were going for every single strong principality and removing them from power so that they can have their hands in the pie, as they say. You know, they didn't want anyone else taking any share. And it was all about money and power. India was a cash cow. As far as the East India Company and then the British Raj after 1857 were concerned, India was a cash cow. India was simply there to provide for the needs of the British elite, so to say. So that's why Indian merchants were taxed heavily. Their industries were completely destroyed to raise businesses in Britain, where India was supplying cloth to the world in the 18th century. It came down to, by 1896, by the year 1896, it came down to India not even being able to supply cloth within India. Only 8% of the cloth was produced within India for the Indians. So Indians started to import cloth from other places, most importantly Britain. So the British East India Company systematically, okay, caused Indian economy to collapse. It took 200 years for the Indian economy to collapse. India, from being one of the richest countries in the world, became one of the poorest countries in the world. Okay, to use an Indian author's words, India, basically the subcontinent, collectively became the poster child of poverty in the world, right? Because of the British rule in India. So after 1803, when they took Delhi, they had their eyes on the Punjab. They wanted the Punjab too, right? But in the Punjab, there was a very strong Sikh army ruled by a very shrewd Sikh ruler, Maharaja Ranjit Singh, who was taking a lot of Muslim territory as well. And he was fought by the Muslims, no doubt, in the mountains, in the Kashmir Valley, the Muslims, including my ancestors again. Okay, this is part of my family history. That's why I'm so fascinated by it. One of my ancestors, he was directly involved in fighting Sikh armies when they came to take territory in the region of current-day Abbottabad in Pakistan, right? And then later on, Sikhs were removed in 1849. Maharaja Ranjit Singh died in 1839, and within 10 years after his death, his sons could not hold on to power. One after the other, they were all killed off, right? After Maharaja Ranjit Singh came his son Khadak Singh, who was basically a drunkard. He died soon after. On the same day of the funeral of Khadak Singh, his son who succeeded him, called Nonihal Singh, was also assassinated and killed by the Sardars themselves. Then another son of Maharaja Ranjit Singh came to power. His name was Sher Singh, okay, who basically ruled for nearly 3 years. He was also assassinated by the Sardars themselves. So these were court intrigues that killed off the rulers, right? And I believe partly this happened because of the oppression of the Sikhs. I'm not saying generally all the Sikhs, but this particular dynasty, right? It was very oppressive towards Muslims, okay? I'm not saying all Sikhs were involved in this, because many Sikhs didn't like Maharaja Ranjit Singh as well, right? So his establishment was extremely oppressive. Now, sometimes people give examples of his, prime minister, for example, he was a Muslim, right? Or his treasurer was also a Muslim. His private physician was a Muslim, right? But that doesn't mean that all the Muslims living in the Muslim territory in the Punjab were happy under the Sikh rule. They were not, clearly not, because they were coming to India, in Delhi, complaining to the scholars of Delhi about this oppression, right? The oppression. And the result of this oppression was a group of people rising from the city of Delhi to go and liberate the Muslims of Punjab. And this movement was led by a man called Sayyid Ahmad Shaheed, rahmatullahi alayh. Okay, he was one of the students of Shah Abdul Aziz, the man mentioned earlier, the son of Shah Waliullah. So he came from the same school, same madrasa in Delhi. Sayyid Ahmad Shaheed, he assembled an army, or let's say a private kind of army of consisting of volunteers from all over India. They went to Afghanistan and they attacked Peshawar and took Peshawar from the Sikhs, and then they started to take more territory from the Sikhs, and then unfortunately they were betrayed by the local tribes, and then they could not go any further. And in 1831, Sher Singh, the son of Maharaja Ranjit Singh, basically massacred them in a battle called the Battle of Balakot, right? This ended that particular movement. But that particular martyrdom of many noble people who died in Balakot, it gave rise to Islam in India. Islam as an ideology was on the decline due to the British rule in India, but that particular sacrifice in 1831, it woke up the Muslims in India. Hold on a second, can this even happen? And it really revived the example of the Sahaba. how they gave their sacrifices, you know, in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this movement is very important, right? There are books written on it. It is called the Muhammadi movement. It was called the Muhammadi movement, okay? And Shah Waliullah's grandson was part of the movement. He also was killed in Balakot in current-day Pakistan, in the mountains. His name was Shah Ismail Shaheed, who is the author of a very famous book titled Taqwiyatul Iman. Taqwiyatul Iman, right? So he was also a part of this movement. So why am I telling you all this? I'm telling you this because the British had caused serious problems for Muslims in particular in India. Muslims are now facing oppression at the hands of the Sikh Empire in the Punjab. And then they were being brutalized by the Marathas as well in those territories where the Muslims live. So Muslims were completely scattered politically. You know, they were completely divided. So they were really, really... And on top of that, for some reason, the Muslims were facing the brunt of the rise of the East India Company in India. In 1830s, the British government abolished the Persian language. You know what happens when you take a language away from a people? You lose everything. All the Islamic literature in the Indian subcontinent, as far as the Muslims were concerned, was in the Persian language. The Urdu language was the language of the masses. It was not necessarily a literary language. It was spoken by the masses. It developed in the 18th century, no doubt. Some of the best poets of the Urdu language were born in the 18th century. So it's a relatively new language in that sense. It's an old language, but in its literary form, it's a new language. Which was the old language? Persian. Spoken for nearly 800 years among Indian Muslims, starting from the time of Sultan Mahmud al-Ghaznavi all the way up to the year 1800. So all the commentaries on the Quran, on hadith, poetry, everything, books on mathematics, on philosophy, you name it, every single subject, on medicine, every single subject, Persian language. All the books were written in Persian language. So the Persian language was the power of the Muslims. And it was so popular and so needed that even the Sikhs and the Hindus had to learn the Persian language to do better in their lives. How do I know that? Today you pick up Sikh coins minted by Maharaja Ranjit Singh. They are in Persian. All the silver coins of Maharaja Ranjit Singh, even the coins minted by the Marathas, Hindu kings, in the Persian language. Their correspondence was in the Persian language. I have documents in my private library, my possession, coming from the Sikh courts, Persian language. So what did the British do? Very clever move. They abolished the Persian language as the language of administration. They replaced it with Urdu and Hindi. And they did this as a deliberate move to take away 600 years, if not 800 years of hard work of the Muslims. They took it in one stroke, 1834. They started to raise these new colleges. They started to attract the Muslims and the Hindus to their new colleges, okay? Where they were teaching practical sciences, you know, engineering and medicine. That's when the scholars of Islam in India, they became, hold on a second, what's going on here? They're trying to take away our youth. That's when these madaris came up. These schools of thought that were born in India, okay, the school of Deoband, Barelawiya later on, okay, and then the school of Ahl al-Hadith. These schools came as a reaction to what the British were doing in India at the time. Okay, albeit in different places, you know, created by different people, but these were the reactions of these scholars of Islam. And one of the reasons was that Muslims had completely lost their faith. They had completely lost any knowledge of Islam and Islamic history. So that's why scholars of Islam from different schools of thought, from different persuasions, they came together and they started working to teach theology to Muslims in specifically designed institutions. Okay, so they were not interested in the English language specifically on engineering and medicine. They were simply worried about Islamic sciences so that our Muslim youth, our Muslim youngsters, our future generations are aware of the Islamic sciences. So it really pains me, my brothers, it really pains me when I see different schools of thought from the Indian subcontinent gunning each other down. They do not acknowledge each other's sacrifices. The Ahlul Hadith will turn and say to the Deobandis, you know what, our guys were the dons. They were doing the wars. They were fighting the British. They were the East India Company. They were involved in the Indian mutiny. The Deobandis turn around and say, no, you guys are a bunch of traitors. You are a product of the British anyway, right? We are the ones. Our scholars went to Malta and they went to prisons and all of that. Okay, then the Brilvis come along and they say, no, both of you Wahhabis are a bunch of nutters, you know. We are the ones who are scholars, you know, all of these names. This is where you are absolutely lost. You do injustice to your scholars and people who sacrifice for this deen. Okay, I say anyone who sacrificed out of sincerity, out of his love for Allah and his messenger, no matter what school he comes from, right? If he sacrificed for the sake of Allah, leave his sacrifice to Allah. You don't judge. You don't judge. How do you know what Allah is going to do with him on the day of judgment? Okay? Start respecting each other. Start acknowledging the sacrifices. You know, wallahi, if I start telling you about the sacrifices of the school of Ahlul Hadith and the school of Deoband and some Sufi scholars, you will not believe it. Okay, the reason why I have sympathy for everyone is because I have seen the sacrifices of every single school of thought or people from different persuasions. They may not agree with each other. At times, they even attacked each other, these scholars. And they were wrong. They made mistakes. They were mistaken. When they attacked each other in these circumstances, they were wrong. We don't have to follow them in that. They were not masoom. They were mistaken. So when the scholars of Deoband were attacking the scholars of Ahlul Hadith, they were wrong. And vice versa. When the scholars of Ahlul Hadith were attacking the scholars of Deoband, they were wrong. Okay? Let them be. Agree to disagree. Let them love the Prophet and Allah in their own way. So this is what was happening. So British establishments were using this to their advantage. Right? So they got rid of the Sikhs as well. They annexed Punjab in 1839. Ranjit Singh died within 10 years in 1849, having fought two wars against the Sikhs, the Anglo-Sikh wars. Okay, both of them were lost by the Sikhs and the British took the Punjab. And the last Maharaja, the surviving son of Ranjit Singh, who was a kid, they took him, they sent him to Britain as an exile, as a political exile. So he grew up here. His name was Duleep Singh. Okay, he grew up in Britain. Later on, he converted to Christianity. Later on, he rediscovered his identity and he went back to Sikhism. Okay, and then he tried to reassert his power, but then his story is another very sad story, which you have to read about.